I should first mention that for the last year I was working with finite dimensional spaces, not infinite dimensional spaces. But I considered for the moment not to speak here because I don't have results from the last couple of years. But I decided to speak about this particular, one particular result, and also on this subject, because of the general interest, which I think is there, and it is one more illustration of the connections between analysis and logic and interest. Also, well, you will see in a moment one more reason why I thought, okay, to present this particular result. So this is the last talk of the conference, and obviously I prepared the transparencies earlier, and so many of my transparencies essentially are a repetition of the notation and notions which were here already, so I will not really comment on this too much. I mean, maybe with one exception, that this notation y precede x is that y is the block subspace of x. Well, I don't know. This is probably not really needed. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, so I'd like to talk about distortions. And the definition was already introduced some time ago. So the space is called arbitrarily distortable if for every lambda larger than one there exists an equivalent norm on the space X such that for every infinite dimensional subspace y of x, this supremum, which is really the multiplicative oscillation of the norm on the sphere of the original space, on the original norm, so if this multiplicative oscillation is larger than lambda. And, well, if we would like to quantify lambda, then we call the space lambda distortable if this holds. And the space is distortable if there exists a lambda for which it is lambda distortable. So the question about distortability in whatever form, it is connected, as it was indicated by Ted and also by some other speakers, it is connected with the stability of, let's say, Lipschitz functions or uniformly continuous functions on the sphere of the infinite dimensional space. And these questions are really interesting for their own right, and in particular also when they were first considered in the 60s, then it was also discovered that some finite dimensional phenomena allow actually such a stability. So the general question is if we have a uniform continuous function on the infinite dimensional sphere, can we find an infinite dimensional subspace such that this function is very close to a constant, it's almost constant. Okay, well, so the questions were considered, and just to make a very brief, to recall very briefly the history, the Cyrilson space constructed by Cyrilson in 72, was, well, maybe not discovered, but it was proved by a particular norm that it was distortable. However, at this time, and I am talking late 80s, maybe the beginning of 90s, this was essentially the only example which we knew, although the Cyrilson space was by this time very well known, and it was used for many counterexamples and things like this in Banach space theory. However, zeros on space was known. I didn't write it here, I wrote it on the next transparency. Zeros on space was known to be 2 minus epsilon distortable and nothing more. And there was a question, so what's so special about 2, number 2? Can we have a space which is 3 distortable? Yeah, this is easy to construct. But then there was a next question which was very natural. Can we construct a space which is arbitrarily distortable? And the notion at this time, even if existed, I mean, there were no examples. And so Thomas Schlumprecht's construction was the first construction of a Banach space which was arbitrarily distortable. Now, there was something magical in this. First of all, it was done already. There was some connection between geometry and structure in this construction. And this construction triggered, by the force of the construction, immediate, very quick solution to the unconditional basic problem by Gowers and More. I mean, it just provided additional information which was missing before. So from the Schlumprecht space, there was the next construction of Gowers and More, of the space which does not contain unconditional basic sequence. And then the same space actually served also as the example, which was recognized immediately, served also as an example of the hereditary indecomposable space. So in fact, it had a stronger property. The Gowers-More space had a stronger property, namely that it was hereditary indecomposable. So all of a sudden, this and then later there were many other examples which were of particular interest for this or other reason. I am just reminding the beginning because I was made aware relatively couple of minutes before the talk, then this beginning of the of this history, which was 1990 maybe, 91, that it was not known. Now the point is that these are structural properties, and these structural properties are in fact attacked via geometric properties, because kind of distortion will relate to geometric properties, and all this step forward, phenomenal step forward, was in fact made by connection of the structural properties to geometric properties. So, right, okay. So, after Gowers-More example, it seemed that the time came already for the distortion problem, and the distortion problem, I am always very bad in covering, you know, the transparency. So at this point, essentially, I am here about biorthogonal distortability. So so the time was ripe to get some results about distortability. And there was a question at this time still open. I am talking about late 91. The question was still open whether a space which does not contain C0 or L1 contains a distortable subspace or is distortable. Or, I mean, there were just examples, but there was no general theorem about distortable spaces. And at this point, Odell and Schlumprecht, again, using a Schlumprecht space, which was this arbitrarily distortable space, but just an example, that they proved that L2, a Hilbert space, is arbitrarily distortable. In fact, they proved more, because they proved this property of biorthogonal distortability, which this is one possible definition, that the space is biorthogonally distortable if we have a sequence of if we have a sequence of subsets of the unit ball in the dual space, such that if we define the nth norm just using these functionals from this particular sequence. So we have this way, we have a sequence of renormings of the space, and then given sequence of epsilons, and we can construct the sequence of renormings in such a way that for every infinite dimensional subspace of X, in this case it will be in L2, and for every I0, which is the index here, there exists a point in the space such that the I0 norm is large on it, and all other norms in this sequence are really small. And this is written how small they can be. So what Odell and Schoencraft showed is that in fact L2 is biorthogonally distortable. And then the proof also worked for LP, for all P between 1 and infinity. And combining this result of Odell and Schoencraft from 92 with the old theorem proved by Milman, by Vitaly Milman in the 70s, well, in early 70s, then it implied that every space which does not contain C0 and L1 contains a distortable subspace. So in particular, Cyrielson space contains a distortable subspace, but in fact Cyrielson space, which we will discuss later, is distortable in itself, as I mentioned before. So clearly, biorthogonally distortable implies arbitrarily distortable, and this implies distortable, and probably these implications, no converse of these implications is true, but we don't have any examples. And in fact, we really know very little about biorthogonally distortable. And, okay. And in this talk, I will be in particular talking about the attempts to understand this implication that arbitrarily distortable, okay, between arbitrarily distortable and distortable. So in particular, there is this question which we will address here. Does there exist a distortable space which is not arbitrarily distortable? So it's an annoying question. Okay, well, maybe I... Okay. First, let me mention that there is also a notion, was introduced in a very natural in this context of bounded distortions. So bounded distortions, the spaces of bounded distortions, if there exists one constant such that whenever we have an equivalent norm, there is always a subspace on which the oscillation is, the multiplicative oscillation is less than this constant. So it's like distortable, but up to a constant. The point is that when we have bounded distortions, the constant is depending on X only. So and this is easy to show, that if space is not arbitrarily distortable, then it's boundedly distortable. So if we have a space, so in looking for the example of this type of space, which would be distortable but not arbitrarily distortable, we want this space, then it will be boundedly distortable. What can we say about such a space, about the structure of such a space? So this is a number of things which we can say. If the space is has bounded distortions, then it must have an unconditional basic sequence. I proved this in 95, and by constructing, under the assumption that the space is boundedly distortable, I constructed not only unconditional basic sequence, but actually the tree, kind of unconditional tree, and then using the ordinal index argument. So I introduced the ordinal index, unconditional ordinal index, which was very similar to the Bourdin index, Bourdin L1 index, which Dale was talking about. Then constructing the tree is larger and larger, and at the end, what you get is the infinite sequence, which is unconditional. So this was this proof. Now, if the space has bounded distortions, then it must contain asymptotical P for some P between 1 and infinity. I write L infinity. I write asymptotical infinity, which sometimes we call asymptotical C0. And I will mention the definition later, but of course it was already mentioned a couple of times. So Vitaly Milman and I proved this, and Moret about the same time, a little bit later, gave a different proof. And then what we also know by now is that if the space does not contain L1Ns uniformly and is asymptotical P, then Moret proved that it admits arbitrary actually then Moret proved that it is biorthogonally distortable. So because of this, so here Moret proved more that it's biorthogonally distortable, but altogether all these things mean that essentially if we would like to find a space which would be distortable but not arbitrarily distortable, then we may assume it has unconditional basis, it's asymptotical P, and contains L1Ns uniformly. And T, Tsirelson space, is a prime example of such a space. Tsirelson also is 2 minus epsilon distortable, as I said before. So my talk really could have been called the quest for distortions on Tsirelson space. I mean, arbitrary distortions on Tsirelson space. And in particular, the technical result, which I will be talking about, was obtained by Ted O'Dell and me a couple of years ago. And however, as you may guess already from this introduction, then at the end we constructed some renorming. But unfortunately, renorming turned out not to be a distortion. Okay, so I would like to describe a little bit the space. The space, the renorming, to state the theorem and to give some ideas of the proof. So again, very quickly, this is the notation which was already used here. We will be using Schreier families, but only finite Schreier families. So on the top of, first of all, I think that S0 didn't appear before, maybe not today. So S0 are just singletons. And then SK is defined as before. And I will call the sequence of subsets, of successive subsets, K admissible instead of SK admissible. Danny was calling it SK admissible today, if the minima belong to SK. And the property which we will be using a lot is the relation between various Schlumprecht Schreier families. We have this operation SK on something, which means that we take a K admissible family of sets, and each of these sets is in Sn, and then we have this equality that Sk of Sn is equal to S of n plus k. And as it was mentioned here, this is not true for higher ordinals, for infinite ordinals, but this is true for finite ordinals. But we will be using only finite ordinals in this talk. Now, I will introduce, it's more convenient to use the more general definition of Tsirelson space, well, more general definition of mixed Tsirelson, let's say, or something. So again, this is the standard notation. In particular, when we have a vector X, then by, and E is a subset of natural numbers, then E of EX denotes the natural projection on coordinates belonging to E. This is the standard notation. And now when we have a familiar F of pointwise compact hereditary familiar of finite subsets of N, let's say containing all singletons, and the fixed lambda, the mix, well, the Tillerson space T generated by this familiar F with the parameter lambda is defined here by the implicit norm. And I think, I am just using one familiar right now. So that's why I have one soup. So we take a familiar such that the minima belong to, we take a sequence of successive subsets of natural numbers, sequence EI, such that the minima belong to F. I would call it F admissible, but I don't really need it later. We use this sequence as partitions of the support of X, and we look at this expression, we take the supremum over all partitions like this, and this expression provides an implicit norm. So one has to prove that such a norm exists, and in this general setting it was proved by Argyros and Deliani. Let's keep it now here. So that's a general definition, and we will use this definition in some cases. So first of all, what did I do? What's the definition of Tillerson space? You can disregard the beginning. So Tillerson space is the space of this form for Schreier S1 familiar with the constant, let's say, a half. The Tillerson space is easy to prove. It's easy to prove that Tillerson space, that the unit vector basis is normalized unconditional basis in Tillerson space. Actually, this is also general fact, that if the familiar F contains S1, familiar S1, Schreier familiar S1, then the Tillerson space generated by F does not contain, I wrote L1, but it does not contain any other LP for obvious reasons, and it does not contain L1. However, these spaces, all these spaces for any F are asymptotically L1, and this means that if we have one admissible family of vectors, successive vectors, which means if I have L vectors, they should start, their support should start after L, then we have a lower L1 estimate for such a sequence. And of course, upper L1 estimate is always true. So in other words, the family, any family of such successive vectors which are far enough, it's equivalent to L1. Okay, so this is the Tillerson space. And now fix N, and let's consider the norm which is generated by the family Sn with this weight 2 to minus N. So I am using this definition with F being Sn and the parameter being 2 to minus N. And we will discuss it in a moment, but turns out that on, let's say, C00, the Cyrils, okay, the Cyrils norm is definitely larger than Nth norm. I think I will discuss both things. But Cyrils norm is larger than Nth norm, and is less than or equal to 2n minus 1 times this. Remember, n is fixed. So in other words, this Nth norm is, it's an equivalent norm, it's a norm on C0, 0, which is equivalent to Cyrils norm. So, as a topological space, this guy is the same as T, Cyrils space T, and it is a renorming. This is simply a renorming. Now, this is a very natural renorming, and in a sense, I mean, well, natural meaning that it is really defined by the natural structure of Cyrils space. And we will discuss it later, but at least on the whole space, we can name the vectors for which this holds and some other vectors for which this holds. But more or less unit vector basis would be like this. Well, we will see it in a moment. So this means that to start with, these inequalities are sharp. These inequalities are attained in the whole space. So perhaps it has a chance to be an arbitrary renorming. I mean, be an arbitrary distortion. This norm has a chance to be an this norm has a chance to be lambda distortion with this lambda. So it was quite a very natural question to ask, is this indeed a distortion? Well, I mean, distortion it may be, but how large is it? So this is the question. Before I state the result, then let me comment on this inequality. Let me comment on this inequality, and let us see how do we calculate the norms in Cyrils space. It's not necessarily my favorite way of calculating the norms, but definitely it is very convenient here. And again, I think my task will be slightly easier because essentially Denny was calculating the norms in mixed Cyrilson the same way. So actually what I am doing here is easier than what Denny had, because this example is easier than the example which Denny had. So I recall the definition of the Cyrilson space, that we take, if the norm of a vector is not trivial, meaning it's not an infinity norm, then what we do is we partition the support of X into some one admissible family of successive sets, and we calculate this expression, sum of EIX, sum of norm EIX, where EI is this one admissible family. So let's say that this is the support of all of X, and I partition this support into three sets. Maybe this is a number three, so then admissible family has just three elements, and we calculate this norm. So when we calculate the norm of this, norm of this, norm of this individually, we add them up, and we put a penalty of 1/2 in front of it. Okay, so this is this line. Now, when we calculate the norm of this by induction, the norm of this is calculated by the same way. So again, either this norm of this is an infinity norm, or otherwise we have to split this interval into admissible family of intervals and calculate and so on. And put the next penalty, which will be another 1/2 here. And so on, and we repeat the procedure. So what do we get at the end? We get this admissible tree, which is easier here in this case. We get this admissible tree that on each step we partition. Okay, well, the description of admissible tree is here. That at each step, we partition the previous node into one admissible family of sets, and we start off with one set. The successors of a node are successive subsets, which is one admissible partition of the previous set, and each of sets which appear here is a successor to something. So what the norm is at the end, the norm is the sum of individual coordinates xi with some weights, and the weight 2 to minus ni. Ni is the number of steps we had to do, the number of levels we had to do to achieve the particular place. So in other words, ni is the level of I in this partition, in this tree. And to calculate, okay, I am not good at this, but I will try to do this. And to calculate the Tyrrellson norm, in fact, we are using just such an admissible tree, and we calculate this, what is written over there, where ni is the level of the set ei. And the supremum is taken over all admissible trees described here. And ei is a terminal set. We are taking the sum only over the terminal sets ei. Okay, so we calculate the Tyrrellson norm by this type of expression, with the supremum taken over all admissible trees, where terminal sets can finish anywhere on any level. Because we go step by step by just one level. It's always one admissible. We are allowed to take, Okay, now, if you think about it, the nth norm, which was obtained by very similar formula to Tyrrellson, except that we were using Sn, so nth norm is obtained exactly by the same formula as before, except that terminal sets now have to have a level which is a multiple of n. So that's why I write n times k of I, to emphasize that a level is a multiple of n. So n k of I is the level of ei. Okay, so now this is completely trivial, that the Tyrrellson norm is larger than the nth norm, because nth norm we are just taking the supremum over a smaller set of trees. Because these trees for Sn, they have to have terminal nodes have to occur on the particular multiple. And we consider one more norm, which is just a technical convenience, but it is needed for the proof. Namely, we consider the very similar expression like here, except that here the terminal sets occur on the levels which are a multiple of n plus fixed j. So you can say that, I mean, if j is less than n, then it would be a remainder. It would be these levels which have the remainder j when divided by n, a fixed remainder. Okay, so this inequality is obvious. And what about this inequality? Well, this inequality is also obvious. Let's see, because you see, Tyrrellson norm is given by some admissible tree. Now, if we have some terminal node in this expression, if we have some terminal node in this expression, and this node happens to be not on the level n, divisible by n, but something else, then what we can do is we can repeat the same set, not to partition it anymore, but just to repeat it formally a couple of times underneath, so that the whole, that the new terminal, the new level will be divisible by n. And, but of course the point is that by doing this, we pay the price of multiplying by how much? Well, it might have happened that we finished off by a constant with a constant a half, that we have to do the n minus 1 steps, so the constant is 2 to the n minus 1. All right, so the inequalities are obvious. Now when we understand how is it calculated, and the thing is now, against our hope, in fact the nth norm does stabilize up to a universal constant independent on n. In fact, more is true. So this is theorem one, that in fact this norm, although natural and nice, but still it stabilizes, it does not provide a distortion. There exists a constant k, independent on anything. In fact, it just depends on the fact that we are taking Pierson space with a half. So there exists a constant k, so that for every infinite dimensional subspace of Pierson space, for any n, there exists a subspace z, a block subspace of y, and some d, such that for all j, this new norm is larger than d and less than or equal kd on the unit sphere. So in other words, on the unit sphere of z. So in other words, I wrote it later. In other words, the largest possible distortion which we can get here is k, which is a uniform, which is an absolute constant, in fact. Yeah. I should have mentioned that this norm, so this contains the answer to the nth norm, because this norm with j is equal to 0 corresponds to the nth norm, exactly. I mean, yeah. Actually, I wrote it here, I didn't say it. Okay, well, this was a little bit of disappointment, this theorem, because we were hoping for arbitrary distortions and we didn't get them. But let's see what does this condition really mean. Well, it means that if we have y, it means what is written here, that if we have y and n, we can pass to a further block subspace, such that on this block subspace z, the very strong oscillation. So if I call infimum of infimum, I call it d, then the supremum of supremum is less than or equal kd. Well, this is just to define the d. And I will think of this d as I would call it, what does it really mean? So I call it sometimes level of distortion, but it may be not a good word. What it really means is this. These norms turn out to be more or less constant. I mean, constant, constant. But what's the value of the constant? And this is more or less, d is more or less what the value of this constant is. So the norm, the new norm is essentially a multiple of the old norm, and this says what the value of this multiple is. And this is an intriguing fact, that whenever we have a situation like this, not necessarily for these norms, but with this, whenever we have such a situation that on some block subspace, we have such an inequality for the norms. No. Yeah, for these norms, then the level of distortion, in other words, D, is of the order n, 1 over n. And this is a little bit intriguing. So you see, originally, this oscillation, originally, our norm, the new norm, was between 1 and 1 over 2 to the minus n, roughly speaking. It turns out that the actual value of this new guy, stabilized value, is about 1 over n. So this is a little bit intriguing, and this is another reason why I decided to talk about it, because all these new norms are in fact more or less constant times the old norm. They are stabilized more or less, but each of them stabilizes on different level. And maybe there is some further possibility of some construction which would use this particular fact. Some further construction which would, at the end, produce an arbitrary distortable norm. Okay, I thought I will be able to show a little bit of the proof, and I may, but first of all, a few structural properties of Cyrilson space, which are extremely important here. And, okay, well, let me start with the bottom ones. The two inequalities here, the first inequality says that in Cyrilson space, when we have successive blocks, yi, these are successive blocks of the unit vector basis, then they are equivalent, the successive blocks of the unit vector basis are equivalent to a subsequence of the basis. And in fact, mi is exactly the minimum of support of yi, and this is the fact well known to us for 30 years, let's say. The other fact is that many subsequences of the basis are also equivalent, not all, by far, but if, for example, I take every third vector of the basis, then it is equivalent to the original basis. Okay? And the first fact is a very interesting fact about the Cyrilson space. So let me explain a little bit again. Part of it, Danny was actually talking about, because this combinatorial construction appears all the time when we talk about distortions or examples, constructions of HI spaces and things like this. And okay, so this is the following, that whenever we have a block basis in Cyrilson space, and whenever we have any fixed, let's say, n, and any epsilon, then we can construct, we can pass to a subfamily of these blocks, which is n admissible, which means Sn admissible, if you want. And we can also pick the positive real numbers, such that if we, okay, in the following way, if we look at this vector, then, first of all, this is a matter of normalization. The sum of alpha L is equal to 2 to the n, but this is my normalization. So the sum of all coordinates is 2 to the n. If you want, you can say that L1 norm of this, no, not L1, sorry. Okay, so this is 2 to the n. Now, the next condition is that if we take the sum over a smaller subfamily, namely the subfamily which is n minus 1 admissible, then what we get is this thing is as small as possible, as small as we wish. Given epsilon, we can construct such a thing which is as small as we wish. And this, the first two conditions, is a combinatorial construction. I mean, it has nothing to do with Banach spaces or anything. It has to do with Schreier sets, of course. And the third condition is the condition of the normalization. What I say here is that the norm of this vector is about constant. K1 is a universal constant. Now, this is the main difference between Tyrrellson space and other, for example, mixed Tyrrellson spaces, which have a chance to be arbitrarily distortable HI spaces or any other, like Denny used today, and Argyros-Deliani and so on. And the main difference is this, that in Tyrrellson space, the norms of these guys are really as small as they can be, because they always have to be larger than or equal to 1. You will see, I think I wrote it, maybe not here, but I wrote it somewhere, that such a norm is naturally larger than or equal to 1, and it is in fact up to a constant as small as it can be. Now, in, for example, in mixed series, in what Denny was using today was that under some conditions in this mixed series on space, which he considered, these norms of vector Z were actually of the order 2 to the n. I'm not saying exactly 2 to the n, but of the order 2 to the n. So this is the main difference. In Tyrrellson, there are no vectors which would have this structure and a large norm. And this is technically the main obstacle. I mean, yeah. This is so important. It has all kind of names. It can be expressed in all kind of, using all kind of names, but okay, maybe I shouldn't go too much in this. Let me just say that, that this combinatorial proposition, if n is equal to 1, then the vectors which we take are just the averages like this over the family, which is 1 admissible. And what we do, for example, and then n minus 1 will be Schreier family as 0. And so what we need to know is that individual coefficient is very small, and so that's why I take m sufficiently large. And how do we get such a combinatorial vector in general? In general, we do the inductive procedure on this. Namely, we take the first average, let's say K1, average of this type. Then we pick K2 depending on the end of K1, depending on the maximum of the support of the previous vector. So K2 is a very large number. And we take the next average, and we take many, many averages, namely admissible number of averages. And we add them together, putting again 1 over m in front of it. So what I wrote, the picture which I drawn here is how do we produce S2? How do we produce such an average of S2? Okay, so let me just say the space which is, let me just describe a little bit the construction of the stabilizing subspace. So, first of all, remember, I am not going through the proofs, through the arguments which I wrote here, but I would like just to describe the content in the statement of the claims. So, first of all, remember that these new norms, Jn, it is the norm which essentially starts with terminal nodes given by the tree with terminal nodes of the form J plus a multiple of n. And because of this, essentially it's easy to believe that more or less, at least on some subspace, if I, if my terminal nodes are either j plus a multiple of n or j plus n plus a multiple of n, well, this is the same thing. So somehow these two norms are more or less equal, at least on a subspace. And so now what we can do is, remember n is fixed, but j, we change j, we consider j from, well, we consider all j, say, from 0 to 2n. So first of all, we have this subspace Y, inside we would like to define a stabilizing subspace, which was called Z at the end. So what do we do first of all? We have these blocks YL, and we can assume that all these norms, we can assume that all these norms are more or less the same. By passing to subsequences, this is a finite number of steps, and we can assume that they are more or less the same. And we also can assume that this thing, that Cj is the same as Cj plus n by the first remark. Okay. Now, the first claim is the following. If we take the vector z, which is of the form as we discussed before, which is such I epsilon average for a fixed I, like this. So this is an I epsilon average. Then we, in fact, can more or less calculate these norms of such particular vectors. And this is the standard situation, really, in all the hereditary indecomposable spaces coming from mixed Cyrielson. Also, in certain way, if you want, you can say also in Schlumprecht space and Gauers-Moore with appropriate interpretation. This is the type of vectors which we can calculate these combinatorial norms on it. And so this is the statement, but I am not going to the proof. And the proof of one inequality, I should say this, the proof, these are two inequalities here. What I mean is upper estimate and the lower estimate. And lower estimate is always easy to prove, because for lower, the norm is given by as a supremum over trees. So to get a lower estimate, we just have to name a tree. And upper estimate is harder, because for an arbitrary tree, we have to do something. So, okay, but we have such a claim anyway. So at this point, we already know that from any block, we can do something like this. And we can calculate these norms. And now, but of course, these norms are different, because we don't know anything about the sequence Cj. It may be very different. Cj's may be very different. But now we stabilize already, because what we say is that we take the sum Zi is the I epsilon average, and now we sum up Zi's, n of them. So we sum up all these averages, one average, two average, three average, and so on. We sum them up, and this is my vector z, and the norm of this vector z, any norm of this vector z, is about the same number. And the number is just the average of the previous numbers. And the proof is trivial, because by the triangle inequality, the norm is less than or equal sum of the norms, but these norms we calculated, and the funny thing is that what we get is a cyclic, we add all these C's here, in maybe cyclic permutation, but, and so what we get is this. So this part is trivial, and this way we produced blocks, Z are blocks of YI, on which all these norms are equal. Namely, they are about C. And the last step is that if we have such a situation, this is the last lemma, that if we have such a situation that we have a sequence of blocks Wi which are normalized in T such that all our norms with a fixed n is fixed but J varies from 1 to n, from 0 to n. All these norms W of Wi are more or less the same, then on the subspace spanned by W's, on the whole subspace spanned by W's, the norms are more or less, I mean, bounded below and above, but around the same value C. In other words, this norm is stabilized up to absolute constant. It's stabilized on the subspace spanned by W's. And again, the proof of one estimate, lower estimate, is easy because it's very easy to construct appropriate trees. Okay, and I think that's all what I can say. I don't have time at all to go to the other theorem, but just to remind you that this other theorem I can just put the statement once more that this other theorem says that all these norms stabilize, so what we proved is that they stabilize, and the other theorem says that if they stabilize, then the level of stabilization is about 1 over n. Okay, I cannot find it. Okay, thanks.